Okay. Thank you to the three of you who reminded me to turn on the iPod today. And my apologies for the couple of you who said that you had to miss class Monday and there's no recording. So find a couple of people who would love to share their notes with you. Anybody will do that because going over it will help them too. Okay. Do we have announcements? Okay. If you weren't here, you could be going to a really interesting lecture. On the evolution of female sexual promiscuity. But this one will be more interesting. And I can't tell you where that one is. So, but tonight there is one right here at 7 o'clock. Remember, this is a cool temperature-wise room. Richard Alley will be talking about global warming and climate change. So this is a great day for him to do that. The title of his lecture is something like How to Control CO2 and Global Warming and Protect the Earth and Get Rich at the Same Time. Yeah. He's convinced that the people who actually develop those strategies for controlling global warming will in fact get rich. So. Okay. Anything else I'm supposed to announce today? Or do? Then I'll turn it over to you. Questions? Nobody's emailing. Yes! Thank you. Yes, the question is, sounds nice up here, I like this. The question is about one of the risk factors for having a low birth weight or premature delivery. One of the risk factors is close spacing of pregnancies. And I think the text, as you quoted it, I think you're correct. It says that if you have one child and then get pregnant again within 6 months. It may not be clear in the text, but it's not if you deliver. Right, no. No, it's pregnancy within 6 months, not birth. Yeah, if you gave birth within 6 months, you would definitely have a low birth weight baby. We haven't figured out how to have overlapping pregnancies yet. So, when we get a little farther along, maybe we'll do that. Any of you interested in assisted reproduction and the legal aspects of that? In vitro fertilization, all those sorts of things. I'll put this on the website, but let me just give you a heads up. How many of you know about the medical grand rounds? One. Two, three, okay. Nursing students, probably. Several of the departments in medicine at the hospital, including OBGYN, pediatrics, psychiatry, those are the three family practice does, I think, but the three that I watch are OBGYN and pediatrics and psychiatry. Every week, each of those departments sponsors a lecture on a particular topic, and those lectures are open to anybody who wants to go, and they are a way that the physicians in the community get their continuing education. Physicians are required, in order to keep their license, they have to have a certain number of hours a year of updated information. The same is true of many professions like psychologists and counselors. But in the hospital, they publish a list for each of those departments of the lectures, and it's interesting to look at what the physicians are learning. And I recommend that you, if you have any interest at all in medical matters, that you check some of those out. Most of the time, they're not so high-powered that first-year students can't follow them. Sometimes they're so high-powered that I don't know what the hell they're talking about. But, you know, you get some language and it's helpful. And I always wonder if I don't understand it, do any of the physicians there understand it? Not sure. Anyway, the reason I bring it up is that next Tuesday's topic in OBGYN, which is 7:30 in the morning on Tuesdays, that probably killed it for most of you, in the new Davis Auditorium, which is in the new Medical Education Center. An attorney will be addressing legal aspects of assisted reproduction. So if you're interested in some of the ethical and legal issues involved in the way we are technologizing reproduction, you might check that one out. I'll be there. And if you show up and say, hi, I'm in five, I'll buy you a cup of coffee after. Wednesdays at 8 is pediatrics, and next week is on whooping cough, or pertussis. So if you've ever wondered why you had to get a shot for that and why it's dangerous, you can go to that one. Psychiatry is much more reasonable. They're 10:30 on Fridays. And I don't know what the topic is Friday. I wasn't interested, so I didn't write it down. Okay. Lots of wonderful things going on here. And late night movies and music and outdoor festivals all weekend, all sorts of things. Outing Club Fest I see on the wall. Audubon Center in Huntington has the Harvest Fest. Shelburne Farms has a Harvest Festival Saturday. That is going to be absolutely fantastic. Not like today, it's going to be in the mid-70s. Okay? What are we supposed to do? Oh, we're supposed to talk about human development. Okay, here we go. You didn't have any questions about it other than that one, thank you. Any others? Yes. I'm sorry? How can jaundice result in brain damage? Give me about half an hour, and I'll give you an in-context description of why hyperbilirubinemia, which is the condition, turns your skin yellow and damages your nerve cells. I'll explain that. Good. Thank you for focusing me on the fact that we need to get there. Okay. That's not a great picture, is it? But if I leave it up there, somebody asked me yesterday in the hallway what a placenta looked like. And that's a placenta. Okay. This is the chorion, which is the membrane that surrounds the fetus and the whole pregnancy. And this one is at the 13 weeks, it says on the note. The placenta is actually a projection of that membrane. It grows out and becomes villous. It has lots of little projections that insert themselves into the convolutions in the uterine lining, and the nutrients and gases are passed through that lining. We'll talk about that in a minute as we talk about birth, because one of the things that we get to do when a baby is born is figure out what to do with the placenta. So that's something you can ask your parents. If they stewed it or buried it under the front doorstep, or planted a tree over it, or did whatever they did. Birth begins. The birth process begins. I ended the lecture on Monday talking about some of the steps in that process. Begins about the about 3 weeks before delivery, as the woman's body develops, secretes more estrogen, which is a hormone that causes the ligaments and the joints essentially to relax, and the baby drops down into position. That's a condition called lightening, or a process called lightening. The whole thing gets lighter and lower, typically placing its head on your bladder and crunching down on the nerves that control your legs. So you know that's happening when you see pregnant women suddenly collapse, because the baby squished the nerve that goes down into the thigh, and they lost control. And I mentioned that the uterus is beginning to practice contracting with Braxton Hicks contractions, and practice that get the uterus coordinated so that it will begin to have effective contractions. And when labor actually begins, those contractions get coupled with the dilation of the cervix, which has been closed up. And as the cervix expands, the opening opens and it expands. The amniotic fluid is discharged, breaking the waters. It's actually a discharge of the amniotic fluid that has been held in by the mucus plug in the cervix. From then on, the process usually continues fairly steadily of increasing frequency and strength of contractions, moving the baby down into the cervical opening and into the pelvis. The cervix has opened here. The baby's head begins to push through that opening, and then if I move over where you can actually see it, ideally the baby has turned itself close to face down, and if you notice, the shape of the head here is interesting. It's kind of round and looks normal. That's beginning to look like a football. That's because the contractions are squeezing the skull and mushing it into a football shape, which reduces its diameter so that it can get through this opening, which is smaller than the baby's head. In the video that we saw, you heard the narrator say that birth is a problem for human beings because as our brains have evolved, our skulls have gotten bigger, and as we've evolved an upright posture, our hips have gotten narrower. Cows don't have any difficulty like that. Dogs don't have much difficulty like that. People, because we walk upright, have a major problem. And the problem is we've got to expand that opening enough and scrunch that poor little kid's head down small enough so that it will come out. That's the most difficult part of labor. You're trying to put a head that's too big through an opening that's too small. How do we accomplish that? Well, one of the ways we accomplish that is having an immature head. If you feel your skull, it feels pretty solid. Okay, don't bang too hard. You might knock things out. But it feels pretty solid. But you all know that a newborn has what are called fontanelles. A spot on the top, a fairly large spot, it doesn't have any bone. It has very tough membranes to protect the brain, but you tell 2 and 3 year olds not to poke their baby sister's head. You know, because you go, oh, that's soft. Let's see if we can put our thumb through it. And you don't want to do that because you can bruise the brain. So you have to protect that. We have evolved brains that are squishable, I mean, skulls that are squishable. And if you look at somebody who's bald up close sometime, I know it's hard to do, but you notice that there are ridges and lines in the skull. Those are called sutures. They are where the original, what is it, seven bones of the skull, don't quote me on the seven because I always forget that one. The skull is originally made up of several different bones and none in the middle. What the contractions do as you put that head down is they squeeze those bones over each other so that it reduces the diameter of the skull. The opening in the middle allows those bones to move upward into that space and assume that football shape. And that makes the head small enough to go through that opening. And then, if you've watched a newborn over the first couple of days, the head gradually becomes normal shape again. To think about the process, how many of you have a metal vegetable steamer that folds so that it'll fit in different size pots? That's what's happening. And when you fold that vegetable steamer that has a lot of plates, the plates slide over each other and make the diameter, the outside diameter of that vegetable steamer small enough so it'll go in your little saucepan or it'll go in your medium-sized saucepan or in your big steaming kettle. That's what's happening to those bones. They're actually overlapping each other around the head to make that pointy shape. Does that hurt the brain? Well, yes, actually, it does. And one of the consequences of the contractions is that you can cause bruising and bleeding of the brain. That's one of the reasons why birth is so wonderfully dangerous for us, because we can do damage to the brain. We try not to do that, but there it is. The other consequence of squeezing the brain is that, let's go out a little bit. Okay. The consequence of squeezing the brain is that it secretes stress hormones, catecholamines, from special places in the brain. You also secrete those from your adrenal cortex even today and from some parts of your brain today when you're really, really scared or really, really stressed. Those stress hormones cause a fight-or-flight response. They jazz up your body. And what happens when you secrete adrenaline and noradrenaline, stress hormones generally, is that your blood pressure goes up. Your heart rate goes up. You become alert. If you were breathing, which the newborn is not, but if you were breathing, your respiration rate would go up. You have a rise in the red blood cells in your system so you can carry more oxygen. So you're ready to fight whatever's scaring you or run away from it. And that's a typical and normal process. What happens during delivery is that those stress hormones go way up. The newborn's heart rate goes way up. And if you stress the infant even more, if it's not getting enough oxygen through the placenta, if the umbilical cord is cramped in some way, if the placenta has partly separated from the uterine wall, the baby's not getting enough oxygen, then the brain responds even more dramatically And if you gave me that much adrenaline, you would cause my blood pressure to go so high that vessels in my brain would burst. But a newborn is just a typical day going through the birth canal. And what that does is to help clear the lungs, which is going to be good, because as soon as the baby's out in the air, it needs to be able to breathe. It needs to expel the fluids from its lung so that it can fill its lungs with air. It's going to increase its metabolic rate, because that's what stress hormones do to you. And that's going to help it maintain its body temperature, which it now has to do because mom isn't doing it. It's going to increase the output of lung surfactant, which I'll talk about in a minute. It's going to increase blood flow to vital organs, including the brain, and it's going to increase alertness. Now, those levels will go down fairly quickly, a couple of hours. But during the first couple of hours after delivery, newborns are very alert, and their bodies are psyched. They're really jazzed up. It's a period during which babies are very alert to faces and sounds around them, and that probably has some connection to making the parents respond in loving ways. If you have a C-section, you don't get that compression. You don't get that big jump in the stress hormones, and so C-section babies have a little more difficulty making the adaptations that are necessary after delivery. So they're less likely to, they get less oxygen for a while, not dangerously in most cases. Less surfactant in the lungs and decreased thermal regulation. And they have a little more difficulty sucking. They look better because their heads aren't mushed. That's the advantage of a C-section. That your head's not mushed. The surfactant, let me elaborate on that a little bit. Surfactant is a soapy substance that your lungs secrete that coats the lung tissue, helps keep the lung sacs open, and eases the transition of oxygen and other gases in and out of the lungs, into the bloodstream. The fetus does not produce much surfactant. It doesn't produce any until about the ninth month. And typically, as the fetus is getting larger and the fetus's body is beginning to send signals that say, hey, I'm getting eager to get out of here, one of the signals is that the fetus begins to secrete more surfactant. And that means the lungs are getting ready. You can actually measure that output in the mother's blood, its byproducts, and so you can tell when a fetus is maturing on the basis of the surfactant. What you want to do is keep the baby inside until its lungs are mature enough and it's going to be able to breathe on its own and get enough oxygen to make that happen. One of the dangers of premature delivery is that the lungs aren't mature. And therefore, the baby is at risk of not getting enough oxygen, which will potentially, if it's serious enough, will damage the brain and retard growth and all of those other things. One of the first advances in dealing with premature babies was to recognize that problem and to administer oxygen to them. And that's helpful because then they get the oxygen. The problem is if you do that over an extended period of time, the higher oxygen levels oxidize lung tissue. So you turn the lungs to leather, and that's not very good. And if you do that, if you damage the lung tissue, then you have more long-term effects. Most of you are not old enough to remember Jackie Kennedy, and you're not close enough to see what I'm writing. Jackie Kennedy had a premature baby, and it didn't live very long, and the cause of birth in the newspapers was cause of death in the newspapers was hyaline membrane disease. And what that essentially means is that they gave the baby oxygen in high enough concentrations and also at higher pressures, and they destroyed the baby's lung tissue. Okay, so that's a problem. Another of the advances was increasing the pressure of the air that the baby is in. So if you know anything about osmosis of gases through membranes, if you increase the pressure of the gases that are on one side of the membrane, it pushes more of the gas through the membrane. So higher pressure and higher concentration of oxygen have been the standard treatments for prematures to make sure that they get enough oxygen. What that meant for many years in prenatal intensive care nurseries was that you had to draw blood every hour and check the oxygen level, which meant that after little Powell, the premature that doesn't have much skin anyway, and it's not very thick and doesn't have big veins, looks like a victim of abuse, which it probably was, because they were poking needles in it every hour. Another of the great advances in treatment of newborns was accomplished here by the development of a photoelectric device that you could slap on the skull and measure the oxygen level in the blood flowing under the skin. And that meant that you could monitor it constantly. That was done here about 25 years ago. And now that's standard practice. So you don't have to poke holes in the kid. And that's good for it. So you can monitor and only increase the pressure or the oxygen level enough to bring the oxygen level up to where you need it to be, so you didn't run as much risk. Most recent advance in dealing with respiration for prematures was also tested here. It wasn't developed here, but it was tested here first. And that was the development of an artificial surfactant, which was done in Japan, based on cow lung surfactant. And now when a baby is premature or born without enough surfactant, they use an aerosol to spray the surfactant right in there. And we have far fewer respiratory problems now for premature babies. Yes? The question is whether boys' lungs develop surfactant at a slower rate or lower level than girls. I don't have a clue. The other half of your question, it's a great question, and I will look it up. Julie, write it down, please. And if anybody knows, let me know. I don't know about surfactant development. My guess is that it would probably be the other way. If anything, my guess is that boys are probably developing it faster, but that's only because I'm biased. Now, it's really based on the awareness that boys are more active prenatally. From about the fifth month on, boy fetuses move more often and more vigorously and spend more of their time moving. And that sex difference is very clear. There's almost no overlap in some of the studies between the active boys and girls who are more passive and wimpy, less active. And that, I'm sorry, that was intentionally outrageous. That difference in activity level declines. Well, it increases actually up to adolescence, through adolescence. The difference gets bigger. Boys are more active on average. And then it begins to decline and probably ends about death. Males are still more physically active. And that's probably due to the genetic difference in the way our brains are wired. The other half of your question, though, are girl prematures more likely to survive than boy prematures, is true. And that's consistent with a much larger body of literature that says that boys are more vulnerable biologically in every way. Boy embryos are more, male embryos are more likely to die. Stillbirths are more likely to be male. Spontaneous abortions are more likely to be male. Birth defects of every sort that can occur in both sexes are more likely for males. Males are more likely to have every kind of genetic disorder that both sexes can have, except those that are clearly sex-linked. And we're more likely to have developmental disabilities, psychiatric disorders. We're more likely to drop out of school in this culture. We die earlier. We're more likely, you know, we're a mess. And I want you to be sympathetic to us. My first year here, I taught a course on the American woman in home economics. We had the first women's studies course at the university, 1960s. I changed the name because there was no way I was going to teach a course on the American woman, so we changed it to Changing Roles of Men and Women. But the textbook was Ashley Montague's book, published in about 1970, titled The Natural Superiority of Women, in which he cataloged in 1970 everything that was known about sex differences, biological sex differences, and we know now that he got all the ones that we knew about then, but we know about a lot more now. So in most ways, biologically, men are much more vulnerable. So treat us nicely. We need help. Okay. And that's probably because we have fewer genes. Women have double X's. We have an X and a Y. And so we don't have two sets of the same genes on the X chromosome. The Y chromosome is a little piddly thing with 30 to 50 genes on it. The X is the biggest one. It has 3 to 5,000 genes on it. So, you know. And the video, again, I keep pointing up there because that's where it was. In the video, there was a comment about getting exactly half of your genes from your father and half from your mother. That's true for girls, but not for boys. Boys have fewer genes, and we get fewer from our fathers because it's our fathers who give us the Y, which is the little puny one. Okay. Important, and I like its effects, you know, being a guy. But. Okay, surfactant. Okay, so make sure you have surfactant. Air pollution and smoke interfere with the production of surfactant. Lungs that are not exercised vigorously lose their volume and produce less surfactant. And as your surfactant level goes down because of lack of exercise, smoking, and air pollution, you lose some of your capacity to respond to physiological demands. And if you go low enough with that, you will die. So treat your surfactant nicely. Don't pollute it. Boy, that sounded like a soapbox, didn't it? I know, a couple of you smoke. I saw you. Quit. Okay, so there you are. You get born. What do you have to do? The major dramatic transition in life. You were inside. You were comfortably plugged in through the placenta, through the umbilical cord. You were a parasite on mom. She gave you all your nutrients. She gave you your defenses, your she gave you your immunity to diseases. She also probably gave you some diseases, but that's another matter. You got your oxygen from her, and then you decided to leave the protective womb, and there you are out in the cold with no placenta. Some of you are probably still parasites on your parents, but it's only through the credit card. Important. What do you have to do? You have very, very little time to do some of the things that you need to do, but there's a list. One of the things you have to do is change the direction of blood in a couple of parts of the heart. These are on the web. Don't break your wrists trying to copy them all down. When you were a fetus, oxygenated blood was coming from the placenta out there through your umbilical cord and up through your liver and into your heart. You're not going to have that oxygenated blood anymore, but you need oxygenated blood. You're going to take the blood from your lungs now, assuming they're working, and that's going to be the oxygenated blood, and it's going to come through into the heart from a different direction. What the heart has to do is close up the connection between the two upper chambers of the heart. And that connection, that opening, is called the foramen ovale, which means oval window, I think. Doesn't matter. So what has to happen is that this is the way it looked before you were... It's easier if I use my new toy, isn't it?
Like this?
Fun. Okay. What happened was, here was the placenta, the umbilical cord went through your belly button. Your belly button doesn't really look like that, but this is a schematic. Comes up through the liver, into the heart. And that's where the oxygenated blood is, and this is the foramen ovale. That's the opening. The oxygenated blood is going both down and across and down, and then up through the aorta and down there. And as it gets depleted, the depleted blood is going up and back into the umbilical cord. But what's going to happen is this isn't going to function anymore. You don't have any need for that. You're going to cut this off with a shell or sharp knife or chew it off, whatever. This one is going to atrophy because there's nothing coming into it that's going to become a ligament. These are going to atrophy because this is closed off. They're going to become ligaments, the lateral umbilical ligaments. You don't have to remember that. You've got these arteries and veins that come through your umbilical cord. The question is, what happens to them? They become atrophied ligaments. There they are. You don't need them anymore. And the important thing is that this opening closes off. The oxygenated blood is going to come down through here, and if you compare them, this was oxygenated blood coming in there. Now it's depleted blood. It needs to go up into the lungs, and you don't want to mix the depleted and the oxygenated blood, so you close off that opening. If you don't, we euphemistically say that the baby is born with a hole in its heart. and that gets corrected by surgery. Actually, all babies are born with holes in their heart. What happens is that for some of us, it doesn't close completely. And that's okay if it's not open very far, but it does mean you have inefficient circulation, and you will have less efficient oxygenation of your tissues, and you get tired faster. It'll also affect your growth rate because you're not getting enough oxygen. So from here, they'll cart you down to Children's Hospital in Boston and do a little open heart surgery and sew that up. And then you'll be fine. If they don't, your growth may be compromised and you won't have as much energy as you'd like to have. It's not necessarily and not usually fatal. Okay, so what you're doing is closing up that hole in your heart, establishing normal circulation, and if you don't, then you're going to have, in our culture, you're going to have surgery. Lung has to mature. In utero, the lung is filled with fluid, amniotic fluid. Not amniotic fluid. It's secreted internally by the lungs as part of the growth process. And then later in, usually in about the eighth month, you do have breathing movements and the baby is adding amniotic fluid to that fluid in the lungs. I need to change this overhead because it says about 40% of capacity with fluid secreted by the lung, not amniotic fluid, but in fact, as you go through the latter trimester, you're going to be adding, in addition to that 40%, you're going to be adding another 30-40% of amniotic fluid. When you take your first breaths, which you will do when you get out into the air because you're annoyed at having been compressed, your blood pressure is up, your heart rate is up, and most babies are going to start gulping. They already know how to breathe, but they've been taking amniotic fluid in and out. Now they get air. And that's what you want to have happen. The lungs begin to inflate. The fluid drains out of them over the course of a couple of days. And you're on your own. If you don't, you're in deep doo-doo. If your lungs don't work, you're not breathing, then the first thing that's going to happen if you're not breathing on your own is that somebody's going to hang you upside down by your ankles and squat your bottom, which is not, in fact, necessary in the majority of deliveries. They always do that in the movies, but in fact, in the delivery room, they often don't have to do that because the baby is doing just fine, thank you, breathing on its own and squalling. The liver. Okay. The liver is responsible for taking care of metabolic byproducts. It detoxifies the blood. And before delivery, the mother's liver was doing all that for you. You were just getting rid of those metabolic byproducts through the placenta, and mom was doing the dirty work, as you'll want her to do for the next few years. There are enzymes that are produced by livers, and those enzyme levels are very low because there isn't demand. But they begin to rise toward birth, toward delivery, and then they gradually increase. The problem is, and this goes to the question of jaundice, the problem is that if you're beginning to eat and you're metabolizing, you're creating byproducts, and if your liver isn't taking care of those, mom can't, and one of them is bilirubin, and it's typically broken down by a liver enzyme. Okay. And the fetus is producing it, but it's neutralized by the mother's liver. The amount increases because you're feeding and digesting on your own. You're actually processing stuff in your gut. And if you build it up, then you have the condition called hyper bilirubinemia. And that means too much bilirubin in your blood because your liver is not doing its job yet. And it often takes 3 or 4 or 5 days for the liver to catch up with what it's supposed to be doing. In the meantime, the body is storing the bilirubin. And where it stores it is under the skin. So what happens when a baby is developing too much bilirubin in its bloodstream is that the body, in its wisdom, puts it in the whites of the eyes and under the skin, under your fingernails, gets it out there as close as it can to the outside. And that's a condition we call jaundice, which may happen to you any time in life if your liver is not working adequately. And one of the problems of drinking too much is that you damage your liver and it doesn't produce the enzymes and doesn't get rid of the bilirubin. So one of the early consequences of cirrhosis of the liver is that you turn yellow. Why does the body put it out there by the skin? I guess to warn us that we have too much of it. I'll give you the other half of that answer in a minute. The problem with bilirubin is that it's toxic. It's a yellowish, waxy substance. It's basically a pigment, fatty stuff that is produced by your gut. And if you build it up so far that the body can't store it, then it begins to destroy your nervous system. And the developing brain of the newborn, which is still developing quite rapidly, is susceptible to that. So the problem, if you don't treat it or if your liver doesn't kick in pretty quickly, is mental retardation, aphthitoid cerebral palsy, deafness, and in the worst cases, death. In most cases, it's okay. It turns out that there's an interesting reason why the body puts it in the skin. And that is that it is photosensitive. Light breaks it down. Light coming through the skin, sunlight coming through the skin, breaks down the molecules of bilirubin. So the body, we have evolved to put that bilirubin in our skin where it will be ideally exposed to light. And that breaks it down, which keeps it from becoming, keeps us from having enough of it to cause damage. Phototherapy is what we typically do in this country when you have a kid with jaundice. You put a bandages over his eyes and put him under grow lights. And the grow lights break down the bilirubin, and it's fine. And then eventually the liver kicks in. That technique also was pioneered here by the same guy who did the transducer, Jerry Lucy, who was chairman of the pediatrics department here for many years and is still active in pediatrics. Jerry specialized his entire career on dealing with newborns and prematures particularly. And he was on vacation in Europe many years ago, and he did what researchers tend to do when they're on vacation. He went to talk to people in hospitals. So he went to a hospital, I think it was in France. I've heard this story many years ago. But if you ever run into him in the hospital, if you're nursing, ask him about phototherapy, and he'll tell you the whole story. He went to a hospital, and he asked the head nurse in the newborn nursery what they did, what kind of problems they saw in kids and how they treated them. And she said, well, the sick kids do better, particularly the jaundiced kids do better if we put them by the window. And he did what any reasonably trained MD in this culture would do with that information. He said, she's stark raving nuts. They are using old wives' tales, mythology. There can't be any truth to that. So he dismissed it and went on. In England, he went to a children's hospital asked the same question, got the same answer. He said, "Oh, Europe is really far behind. They really think the kids get better if you put them by the window." He mentioned that to somebody here who was a chemist, and the chemist said, "That makes sense because bilirubin breaks down in sunlight. So if you put the kids next to the window and they're exposed to more light, it would probably work." So he apologized for his thoughts about Europe and said, "We have a problem in our hospital over there. No windows. Newborn nurseries are always in the middle where they'll be close to all the services, and they don't have any windows. That's typical in the United States." So he invented phototherapy. Let's use grow lights instead. So that's why we do that. And it's the bilirubin that destroys brain cells. That is the problem. Okay? Your kidney needs to mature. Let's get your kidney moving. It removes waste products and concentrates urine and maintains homeostasis in the acid-base relationships, the acidity of your blood and chemical processes that are necessary for nervous system activity. And the kidneys need to do that. If your kidneys don't function, then we have a problem. And as you know from not hopefully your own experience, but for many of us, the experience with elders approaching death is that a cause of death is kidney failure, because those things that the kidney is supposed to do stop happening. Okay, a couple of other things I don't have overheads for. We mentioned metabolic rate and maintaining your own temperature, and that's important. So babies have to figure out, their bodies have to figure out how to increase their burning of nutrients, the cellular activity, to increase body temperature. If you don't, you get too cold. If you metabolize too quickly and burn too much, then you get hot, the fever. So the way our bodies work is that we constantly adjust our metabolic rate. We start being more active metabolically or less active so that we can maintain our, I don't know, any of you really 98 point whatever, 6? I haven't been over 98 degrees ever. 97, 96.5, I'm just that way. Which is neat because it means that in cold weather I don't get as cold as other people. Because there's less contrast for me. Babies do this interesting thing of over-adjusting for a while. So babies will go from getting really cool and fussy to squalling and crying and wiggling around, and then their body temperature goes way up. So they're doing this all day long, until gradually they smooth that out and gradually can maintain their body temperature on their own. Another of the adjustments that the baby has to make is creating its own defense system. It has to begin to develop immunoglobulin. One form will be passed in mother's milk, but not all forms. It has to begin to develop antibodies to things that it needs to resist. And that's one of the reasons why some of us say that kids need to be exposed to colds and other things that they're likely to have to resist the rest of their life. Begin to stimulate the antibody production system. Kids who are not exposed to anything have more difficulty, some of us believe, have more difficulty fighting off things later. So make your baby sick, it'll make it healthier. No, that's, you didn't hear that here. Let's see what I've missed. Kidneys, metabolic rate. Okay. On track. So, what's a newborn like? Here they come. I'm going to talk about physical characteristics of newborns that are fun and neat, but also serve to begin the process of creating social relationships. So this is a place where the biological development intersects with psychosocial development. The baby comes with the physical foundation. Okay, I'll give you time just to look at that, pick up a couple of words, then I'm going to turn the lights up so you can see me. Okay, I'll come back to that. Okay, vision. What can babies see? Your grandmother said baby can't see anything, don't worry about it. Grandma's wrong. The book says babies don't see very well, and their acuteness is the word they use, which has no scientific standing. Acuteness increases gradually. Whatever they mean by acuteness probably does. There are two things to think about in terms of vision, and that is acuity, which is how fine discrimination you can make. That's why the ophthalmologist looking at you as you look at a bunch of little narrow lines that get closer and closer together to see how far away and how long you can see them, how close they can be, and you still see them as separate lines. That's a measure of your acuity. Newborn's acuity is just about the same as an adult's. Acuity is based on the shape of the lens, and the baby's eye is completely formed at birth. It can respond to the entire range of colors, with some limitations that kick in a bit later. It doesn't see as well in the dark as you do, but it's essentially completely formed, and its acuity is essentially normal, so that's not a problem. Accommodation is the other part of seeing, and accommodation is the ability to change your focal length. Okay, you know what that means, right? Look at me. That's an order. Look at me. Suck it up. Look at me. And then look at your notes. Okay, more dramatic. Put your finger up in front of your face. Between you and me. Look at your finger. And look at me. Then look at your finger. Then look at me. Okay, feel what you're doing with your eyes. That's accommodation. Visual accommodation. You are changing where you are focusing. Babies, newborns, can't do that. Because it's dependent on muscles in both eyes that have to get strengthened and coordinated so that they can change how far away they are focusing. And that requires time. They have to practice, and that will take them several weeks to master. The really cool thing about babies' accommodation is that their eyes, typically, as the text said, are focused at a particular distance away. There is no theoretical reason for that to happen. Theoretically, there's been no light in the womb. There is no reason for their eyes to be focused at all, anywhere. So theoretically, one eye could be looking there and the other eye could be looking up there. And in fact, you'll see at times newborns and infants will do that. They're it's just really weird. Some of you know adults who are kind of like that too. Three drinks and looking here and one eye is over there, and there are psychiatric disorders in which people don't focus on the same thing too. But newborns don't come like that. Theoretically, they could be looking at the back of the room. They could be focused 500 feet away, the middle distance, infinity, it doesn't matter. They could anything, because they've had no reason to accommodate. So theoretically, your eyes don't have to be focused at all, and they don't have to be at a particular focal length. The reality is, probably a result of mother evolution again, the reality is that most babies come with a fixed focal length, like your cheap camera. And that fixed focal length is 10 to 12 inches away from their noses. That's really weird. Why would most babies around the world be focused at that? So, if you want to see, they are. So here's what a baby sees. Do this. Finger again, 10 to 12 inches away. Look at your finger. Focus on your finger, but think about me. I am really fuzzy, aren't I? I am really out of focus. But your finger is in focus. You can see that. That's what a baby experiences all the time. It can see anything that's 8 to 10 inches away in clear focus with good acuity, and everything else is, as William James suggested, a booming, buzzing, buzzing confusion. That doesn't mean everything is confused. It means everything except what's 10 to 12 inches away is confused. And it will stay confused until the baby, through practice, following objects, trying to focus on things out there, will strengthen those muscles and develop, again, over 5 or 6 weeks, the ability to accommodate the way you and I do. What would be the evolutionary reason for focusing 10 to 12 inches away for babies? Yeah? Breastfeeding. Got to find it? No. What's happening? Explain yourself. When you are breastfeeding, when you're at the breast as a baby, what is likely to be 10 to 12 inches away? Mama's face. So from the very first feeding at the breast, the baby is focusing and can focus only on mama's breast. What else? Cool signal there. What else? Why else might?
Or maybe that's for bigger babies.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Yeah? Why do we put those, the comment is that, so you can see toys. Why do we put those toys at that distance? We do. What's the first toy? Ease. Hands. Hands. Hands are the toys. Oh my goodness. If you measure, here's the baby. Hopefully it has two hands. Random movement. It's generating random movement. If you measure the distance from the eyes to the hands, while the baby is moving its hands, the average distance is 10 to 12 inches away. So the baby comes focused on the two, three most important things in the world. Mother's face, or whoever's breastfeeding it, if dad's breastfeeding it, there's dad's face too. If dad's bottle feeding it, there's dad's face. Whoever's feeding it in that position has a face 10 to 12 inches away and its own hands. And those are the most important things in the whole world. Whoever's feeding it and its own hands. The fact that we put the mobiles up there is derivative. We know that babies can focus there. We want to attract their attention. And so we put the toys that far away from the baby's face. But the baby comes equipped with its own toys, which it will manipulate and play with as long as it possibly can. Oh, and then there are a couple of other characteristics. One of those is that babies prefer faces to look at over anything else. They prefer edges and contrast. So they come prepared to discriminate objects from the rest of the world, because objects have edges, and typically a contrast with whatever's behind them. They prefer moderate complexity rather than something that is too complex, and they prefer anything that looks like a face, and real faces are the most interesting things you can show them. And you don't have to go very far to figure out that that would be helpful in developing your social connections. Okay, what about the ears? Interesting. Babies can hear. They've been hearing in utero. The ear is complete. The inner ear is complete. The middle ear is complete, almost complete. But they will respond to the entire range of sounds that you will respond to, and they can discriminate them. And that range is approximately about 20. That's not a 2, Larry, that's a 6, okay. So about 20 cycles per second, or hertz as we call them, up to about 20,000 cycles per second. 20 is the lowest note your synthesizer can produce, and many of them can't produce that. It's the lowest note you can detect as a sound. Below that, it becomes a vibration, not a sound. 20,000 is the annoying little whistle that some TVs emit that drives you nuts until you lose enough of your acuity in your hearing so that you don't hear it anymore. I'm down to about 17,000. I've lost about 3,000 cycles per second up there, so the big high stuff I don't hear. Let me again bring the lights up and elaborate on this. Babies can respond and do respond across the entire range. That's the same range that you respond to. What else do you know about the range on a piano? Anybody know? Yeah. Your piano, 88 keys, the lowest is 28 cycles per second, and the top one is 4214. Okay, so the piano doesn't do the high stuff. That's why you have to have some of the other instruments in the orchestra. Dogs? How many of you have dogs? Same range as humans, plus. How many of you have a silent dog whistle? None of you call your dog with one of those things that you blow through, and your dog goes... Okay. Well, the reason it does is that those things are about 23,000 cycles per second. You can't hear it. Your dog goes nuts because the dog's hearing is more acute. Any of you hang out with dolphins? You've heard the dolphins, right? They can hear sounds that are so high, you can't even imagine how high they are. Whales, similarly, not quite as high as dolphins. You've heard the Song of the Whales, Song of the Humpback Whale, that wonderful recording, and some of the others. Whales not only hear those sounds, they emit them. They can emit sounds that are so high that we can't hear them. So how do you hear them on the recording? They slow them down to the computer. What you're hearing that you think is the humpback whale is not what the humpback whale sounds like. It's been computer processed to bring the frequencies way down into the human hearing range. So, what's cool about babies is that they respond to the whole range, up to 20,000 or so, but they prefer sounds that are in the range, a very narrow range, of about 800 to about 1,000 cycles per second. Why? You can play sounds any place in the range. They will hear them. They'll respond to them. They prefer. We're just generating these with a synthesizer. Just playing tones. They prefer sounds that are in this range. The average male adult voice, about 1,000 cycles per second. Women, a bit lower. They prefer human voices to any other sound at birth, actually before birth. It works with prematures too. And let me give you one more interesting fact about the hearing. Babies discriminate very easily between 1,000 cycles per second and 850 cycles per second. And if you want to alert them, I'm sorry, I think I just did something entirely wrong. I just did this backwards. I'm sorry. You knew that. Women are higher. I'm sorry. Women's voices are higher than men's, right? Yeah, I got it. Missed that in graduate school. Sorry. If you want to get a baby's attention, you go to the top of the range of human voice. So that's why when we want to feed that little baby, we want to kick him right down in his face, 10 to 12 inches away, and then we raise our voices just as far as we can, because that's the most alerting thing, and the baby's just going to love that, and we're going to look at the sun when you do that. Okay, which is why babies are more responsive to women. I've got 1 minute, I'm going to use it. The other side of that is at the lower range, male voices down here are more calming. Babies are more likely to calm if you use a low voice. The practical application of that is that when you're singing lullabies and want to put a baby to sleep, higher an alto or a bass. Hire somebody with a low voice or cultivate your own. If you have a fussy baby and you want it to calm down, give it to its father because he will be more successful in calming it down. Most women discover this very early and it annoys them that the fathers are more successful in calming fussy babies and putting them to sleep. Okay, we'll see you Monday.